Hello, and welcome to the interview series, New Books in African American Studies, where writers of African American life and culture discuss their new books. I'm your host, Sherry Johnson, and today I'm happy to speak with Shireen Sherrard Johnson, professor in the English department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and author of Dorothy West's Paradise, a biography of class and color, published by Rutgers University Press in 2012. If you want to learn more about Dorothy West, geographical and social landscapes, intra-racial class and color, and how they all come together in West's writings, you need to read Shireen Sherrard Johnson's book. In our conversation, the professor discusses Dorothy West, her movement from Boston, Massachusetts to Oak Bluffs, Martha's Vineyard, from Oak Bluffs to Harlem, New York, from Harlem across the ocean to Moscow, Russia, and how West's writing reflects her travels to these various locations. I'm sure you'll enjoy this lively interview. Listen in. Today we're talking with Shireen Sherrard Johnson, and she's going to talk to us about her new book, Dorothy West's Paradise, a biography of class and color. Good afternoon, Shireen. How are you?
I'm very well. Good afternoon, Sherry.
Okay, great. Let's just jump into it. Before we talk about the text, can you just tell us a few words about yourself?
Sure. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. Lived there much of my early life with my family. My family actually migrated, many of them from the southern part of Louisiana, New Orleans, and also Shreveport. But I grew up in Los Angeles, very much an Angeleno. I went to UCLA for undergraduate and then to Cornell to pursue my PhD in English. And it's from there that I really got started in my commitment to Black women's literature, 19th and 20th century African-American literature, and especially the Harlem Renaissance. My dissertation was on the Harlem Renaissance and the interaction between visual art, visual culture, and literature. And that was the main project at that time. And I've gone on to teach many courses and to write articles in that area, especially not just the Harlem Renaissance, but around recovering the lives of Black women artists and writers, especially, has been an interest of mine. And some of that interest has led to the book that we're going to talk about today.
All right, cool. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about who your mentors were and maybe how they affected the ultimate choice you made in the area of study that you like.
Right. I think that, you know, it's interesting. I always loved reading and writing. And I feel like instrumental in my early stages when I was an undergraduate, people like Valerie Smith and Richard Yarbrough, who were professors at UCLA at the time, really opened my eyes up to the field of African American literature. I really see them as sort of groundbreakers in that field. When I made the transition to Cornell, I was very much trying to keep in mind both my work as a critic and also my work as a creative writer, because I also write creatively as well. And Cornell was a great place for linking those two together. There I worked with people like Hortense Villars and Ken McLean. And from Cornell, I went to my first job at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and there the late Nellie McKay was certainly instrumental in bringing that kind of integrity to the work that we pursue.
Definitely. I mean, she affected me as well in the choices that I made and where I decided to go in my scholarship, particularly with Black women writers. All right, so good. Let's move into talking about the book. Tell us a little bit how you came to write Dorothy West's Paradise, a biography of class and color.
Well, Dorothy West was a writer that we very much associate with the Harlem Renaissance, and having written a book that primarily focused on women writers during that period, I always felt a little guilty that there wasn't a chapter on Dorothy West in that first book that I did, Portraits of the New Negro Woman. And part of the reason is because she comes to Harlem very young, and she doesn't publish her first novel until the late 40s, until 1948, when she publishes The Living is Easy. And because of that, she fits uneasily, I think, within the markers we often think of as the Harlem Renaissance, even though she's considered a Harlem Renaissance writer. And so I'd done some work on her. I'd published an article on her before in the African American Review, and she just lingered in my mind. During my dissertation research, I found a manuscript, a handwritten manuscript of The Living is Easy, and it was just wonderful to read through that and to kind of hold that in my hands. But you know, so she just lingered as someone who I wanted to return to. I was just fascinated by her work on class, especially, and how she looked at class relations among Black women and men, and not just in terms of, you know, Black and white as a kind of class divide, but interracially as well. Mm-hmm. And I think those interests stayed with me. And then I was actually on the island of Martha's Vineyard in Oak Bluffs doing research on another writer, Emma Denham Kelly Hawkins, who at the time was presumed to be a 19th century African-American writer. Later, it was discovered that she'd been misidentified. And it turns out that she was, in fact, Anglo-American.
Wow.
And so I was doing this research on her really at the moment that that news broke. And I experienced a kind of rift in terms of, what am I doing? Who am I looking for? In terms of just the work of recovery. And I literally found myself on Dorothy West Boulevard in the area in which she lived in Oak Bluffs. And from there, I went to the Martha's Vineyard Museum, where they have historical archives. Many taped interviews with Dorothy West. Her Vineyard Gazette articles are also cataloged there. And so I began to, you know, I think then do the early foundational work of returning to her and thinking about her, not just in terms of doing a literary biography, but also a biography that was very much centered on place. Mm-hmm. And that was really, I think, making that shift. It's very similar to the work I've done in terms of recovering Black women's lives, Black women's writing, but a little bit different, I think, in that I very much wanted to explore the issue around class division and also space and geography within her writing, but also within African-American culture in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it seems like she literally jumped up and asked you to write about her this time, right?
I felt a little like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so then it seems that or maybe I should ask the question, is there a problem you're trying to solve in this text? I know that you're interested, or you said that you're interested in recovering or continuing the project of recovering Black women's writing from this period. But is there a particular problem that you are trying to address in the text?
I think the problem is understanding the relationship between, or understanding, I guess, the subtleties and intricacies of class in the African-American community. It was my sense that you couldn't just think about class in the Black community the way we thought about it in mainstream culture, that those lines are often muddled, that wealth, even when it's passed on, it's sometimes not passed on intergenerationally in the same way that it has been amongst like established families like the Kennedys or the Vanderbilts. Mm-hmm. There are fits and starts, and many of these are a response to the persistent economic discrimination within the Black community. And so I was very interested in how those individuals struggled within mainstream culture to surmount difficulties, the kinds of strategies they used to negotiate, to create a space for themselves that would be alongside, but also separate from mainstream society. And mm-hmm. I saw the community of Oak Bluffs as one such site.
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, I think about it almost as a nationalist site, but it's not usually how people would think about nationalism, because usually the upper middle class Black community, they've been in many ways considered, you know, the bourgeoisie, you know, going back to E. Franklin Frazier.
Right.
It very much has been the underclass. It's been the focus of study. And it makes sense, because that's the majority and the hyper-focus within Black studies would be on the underclass. But I think that looking at the connections between those two groups, the notion of what some sociologists and economists refer to as linked fate,
mm-hmm.
And how that's changed over time, especially mm-hmm. in a moment now when we are really dealing with very deep class divisions throughout the country among all ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this would be both a timely project, but one that would also answer questions that I had about trying to understand the cost of class mobility within.
Okay, good. All right, so then you begin the biography by discussing the beach in Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts. Can you talk about your decision to do that? How did it come about?
Yeah, well, I think I wanted to shake up the form of biography that begins with birth and kind of ends with death.
Yes.
Because that wasn't the kind of project that I wanted to do. And so I felt like by discussing a beach, I would keep the focus on space, which was something I really tried to continue to think about throughout the book as
yes.
a factor in terms of class, environment, lifestyle, all of those things. But also in that way, be able to trace not just the history of a writer's life, but also a history of a place and how they converge with Dorothy West. And the story about the beach that you're referring to is one that Dorothy West returned to again and again. It's how she feels as if these interlopers from New York lost the beach for the Black Bostonians, a beach that they had free access to from their enclave in the highlands of Oak Bluffs, which later became privatized. And as a result, they ended up having to use a different beach, which was the public beach, a beach that would later become known as the Inkwell. And there are lots of stories about how that beach got its name. But Dorothy's particular interest in this beach is that it represents a kind of loss of what may have been a tenuous interracial harmony. Mm-hmm. And that loss is sparked by essentially the failures of understandings in terms of behavior and respectability and a kind of disjunction that occurs between the African-Americans from New York and the ones from supposedly from Boston. Mm-hmm. But smuggled within there are all kinds of issues around Southern migration as well. A lot of the things that she associates with New Yorkers are the similar things that she would associate with Southern immigrants to Boston as well. And so it's really there that you get to see where some of these class divisions come out and how they're defined by region, not just by economics, and certainly not just by race. So that was, I think, one of the reasons why I wanted to start there, to really foreground that my perspective was going to have this focus on class, but was also going to be very interested in how both how by moving through different spaces, Dorothy West's perspective changes. So Oak Bluffs is one important site in the book. There are other sites that we move to throughout. So the book, I wouldn't say it's completely structured along spatial lines, but the story of these places, I think, is in many ways is a story that I'm also trying to tell as well in a specific period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the connection that you draw between the history of place and the author's life is definitely a main tenet throughout the entire text that I really enjoyed. Can you just talk a little bit about what the relationship is between geographical and social landscapes as well as the individual?
Yeah. Well, I think on one hand, this is an artist's journey, right? So it's looking at the places that she drew from both in her fiction, but also in terms of what inspired her to write and inspired the interest she had. And I think beginning in Boston is certainly a critical site for her within a rich Black community with that long history of abolition, but also a very much a writerly history as well. That was really where her early years were nurtured in Boston. There are certainly literary foremothers associated with that site, namely Pauline Hopkins as being an early writer there, but also Trotter's newspaper. So she really grew up in this literary environment, also an environment that was highly matriarchal in terms of her mother and her aunts, who were very much strong women determined to raise children that would be able to gain a foothold in society. So Boston, I think, is very instrumental in her early years. Very early, they do begin to go to Oak Bluffs. And over the course of her life, Dorothy goes from there to ultimately to Harlem, at one point to Moscow and to London. Mm-hmm. And every space, I look at these spaces or consider them as possibly or potentially utopic sites. That is the sense that what about these places might make them protective spheres, either for artistic development or spheres that can be, I'm not sure if insulated is quite the right word, but maybe antidotes to racism and to Jim Crow, right? Mm-hmm. So part of what she's looking for in the groups that she's surrounded by are looking for places where Black art, Black writing can emerge, not so much unfettered, but maybe in a way that it is less claustrophobic, right, mm-hmm. than the society that, the segregated society that evolved after Reconstruction, mm-hmm. And moving especially into the 20s and into the 30s with the Harlem Renaissance, that optimism is very much present. It diminishes, obviously, with the Depression historically. So there's a kind of historical arc going along here as well. But looking at what, when she moves through these different spaces, what she's looking for mm-hmm. Is often, a kind of space that would allow an art that can challenge, I think, some of our expectations of class mm-hmm. and race and gender, but also poke fun at them as well. Mm-hmm. Lots of West writing is very satirical. And so, you know, it's often tricky to determine when she is very much invested in the kinds of representations that she's creating or when she's really making fun of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's led to some misconceptions about her work and her life as well. And like all individuals, she's a complicated person and changes over time. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, that was something I had to struggle with. Mm-hmm.
For sure. You draw on Alice Deck's definition of autoethnography. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by the definition, which if I read it here, it says self-reflective narratives in which the authors consider and examine themselves as native to the environment of examination. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how Dorothy West's text or her texts, okay, can fall into autoethnography.
Yeah. Well, I think she always saw herself, I think, as an insider outsider. Mm. So in many ways, you know, she was a product of all of those environments that I've talked about in terms of both New England and Boston. But, you know, her mother was from the South, and so she also felt she could write about the South as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that insider outsider perspective both gave her a kind of legitimacy and authenticity when writing about those spaces, but it's also what allowed her to kind of pull back occasionally and comment and critique what she saw sometimes as destructive maneuvers within the spaces that she occupied, mm-hmm. especially around marriage. And she wrote so often about marriage,
right.
And marriage as a possible consolidator of capital that allows Black middle-class success, but also when it is viewed in such stark terms, often leads to unhappiness and dysfunction. And that's a theme that carries out through much of her work. And I feel like looking at those, the people who move within those spaces and that sort of insider-outsider perspective, she's almost like one of her influences, Zora Neale Hurston, mm-hmm. who certainly in her work in terms of collecting stories as an anthropologist, but also writing her own stories, adopted that similar kind of stance mm-hmm. where she could understand and was definitely part of the community, but also hold herself apart to offer a kind of commentary that would allow others in.
Yes, definitely. Okay, so your mention of Zora Neale Hurston as a mentor to Dorothy West, there's another line in which I can see a correlation between their work, or maybe not correlation, but elements of similarity in their work, which is the blurring of fact and truth. Can you talk a bit about the African American narrative convention, really, because it's a legacy in which they're engaging, of blurring fact and truth, and how Dorothy West follows or does not follow in that literary convention?
Yeah, I think I guess to talk about that as a kind of convention, I mean, obviously, you know, Henry Louis Gates talked a lot about the idea of the trickster figure within mm-hmm. African-American narratives, and the idea of perspective, I think very early, even in slave narratives, needing to tell the truth. And I think this is Zora Neale Hurston's line, tell the truth, but tell it slant, you know, in a way that would achieve, and at least with the slave narratives, their political goals, right? So using the literary conventions to tell a kind of true story, a kind of witnessing or testifying. And that's very present, I think, from the 19th century on into the early part of the 20th century. With Zora Neale Hurston and many women writers actually from the Harlem Renaissance, there was also a kind of pressure to disguise certain aspects of their biography, especially at a time when what was being rewarded was the young male ingenue. Mm-hmm. And so women often, Zora Neale Hurston is an example of this, but there are others as well, often shaved years off their age to make themselves appear, you know, more appealing and young, you know, to that literary audience.
Brand new.
That. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that's still present.
Right.
In our culture. So that was there. But there was also a way that for Dorothy West, in terms of her own life writing, very much created a persona that would mask or emphasize certain aspects of her life and maybe de-emphasize others. And she told these stories. I don't quite argue that they're necessarily political, but they're a story that very much fits in line with what the history is that she wants to convey about her family, about her own personal history. And so one of the things that you find out are that there's a lot in her early years in terms of her family structure, especially centering around her mother and the different ways she cast her mother as a strong figure in her life, the story she tells about her family. But there isn't very much about her adolescence, really, right?
Right.
And to get to her writing, and then you can begin to follow her history through the writing. And I think as a scholar, kind of sifting through fact and fiction, and you know, when you the lines were definitely blurred, and many of the stories that she wrote, people have read as autobiographical, and certainly they have those elements, but they also stand as fiction on their own.
Sure.
And so, within my text, I didn't necessarily try and sift through and say this is fact, this is fiction.
Right.
I was very much interested in the interplay between the two, and what was what stories. Rather, instead of trying to figure out whether or not the story she told about her mother is true, what is that story? How does that resonate? Why is this a story that she returned to again and again?
Sure, sure, sure.
That's my interest there.
Sure, sure. Particularly, obviously, in terms of class and color, right?
Right.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's move to Moscow now. Let's go to Russia, your chapter on To Russia with Love. Here, I can definitely see a clear return to the connection between nature and personal and or social landscapes. In this chapter now, you bookend your discussion of Dorothy West's writings with Nancy Prince's, narrative in the life and travels of Mrs. Nancy Prince, written by herself, published in 1853. And then at the end, Andrea Lee's Russia Journal, published in 1979. Can you just talk a bit about the literary legacy in which you've placed these women, all three of these women, and how you're fitting Dorothy West in?
Yeah, sure. Well, I was very interested, and as I began to do the research, the contextual research for this chapter, about the Black presence in Russia and how early it went. The idea that even in the 1850s, right, you had women, Black women traveling to Russia while slavery was still going on in the U.S.
I was surprised by that. It was really, really eye-opening.
Right. That this is a free woman. You know, she gets on a boat and she goes to Russia. She's not there as a slave. She's part of a diplomatic, attaché, that her husband is working for the Tsar, and she offers this travel narrative from that period. And I thought that was a fascinating way to think about what it meant then some 70 years later for Dorothy West to be on a ship going to Moscow with this Black and white group to make a film about oppression in the U.S. and what that trying to put her in a kind of continuum, to not look at that as something that as a blip, right, but as part of a larger story about Black women's travel writing. And I think in many ways that chapter is, it's about Dorothy West, it's about Moscow, but it's also about Black women cosmopolites, right? Making their way through the world, interacting with different people in different cultures, and how they have to contend with the biases of race and gender and class that enact upon them. Mm-hmm. And that was very much present in Nancy Prince's narrative. And it's also present even into the late 20th century with Andrea Lee's journal, although she very much cloaks how she is read visibly, and that she really doesn't disclose that she's African-American until three quarters of the way into the book. Mm-hmm. And so then as a reader, it's hard to discern, right, how racial difference appears there. The gender, the gaze, that's certainly present in her work. But I definitely see her or see these, part of why I use them as bookends for West Story is to try and understand what Russia might have symbolized beyond just, say, a communist experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Or even as something that demonstrates any of the author's commitment to Marxism or a kind of radicalism, because one would never characterize really Dorothy or even Andrea Lee in that way.
Right.
So part of what they're looking for in Russia and what they get is a certain perspective on class stratification and how under a socialist system it might be different. But what they don't necessarily, neither of them come back communist, right? And in Nancy Prince, her feelings about Russia are very much, are obviously earlier, right? This is Tsarist Russia, Imperial Russia, mm-hmm. that she's visiting. And yet there's a strange consistency amongst this 150-year span. And I know historians probably think, oh, how can you put together these such different right. time periods?
Right.
But I really do see that, you know, what I'm following is the idea of, you know, the Black woman traveler.
Mm-hmm.
And we think of their world, especially in the early 19th century, as being very circumscribed, as opposed to one in which boundaries were more fluid and which people learned to negotiate and manipulate expectations in order to achieve a kind of mobility that we often don't expect women in that era to have.
Right, right, right. I wanted to read a quote from that's from the chapter where you're kind of talking about how all three come together. And it says, quote, "The frame stories included here demonstrate that Black women's perspectives on their various Russian sojourns are highly attentive to the social reception of their bodies with that space, the luxurious and bourgeois indulgence that their specialized status allows, and the contrast between their treatment in Russia and their lives behind the veil of American race relations. They also demonstrate that travel writing is by its very nature impressionistic and irrevocably informed by the personal," end quote. Can you just talk a bit about the importance of travel in general, but to Russia in particular, to the development of identity as Black women for Prince, West, and Lee?
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Well, I think in general, what it allowed, I mean, it allows something different for each of these women because they're writing from very different specific historical periods. But I think what it enabled, certainly for Dorothy West and others who were part of that Russia trip, was a removal from the context of U.S. racism that, in many ways, for people who are middle class, they really saw the circumscription of access to things which financially they should be able to do, like eat in restaurants or go to the ballet or these kinds of cultural events that middle class people were beginning to partake in, mm-hmm. that they were not allowed to partake in because of Jim Crow, even as it stretched into the North. And so being in, they had an acute perspective of being prevented or of not being able to access that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Russia, because of their specialized status as foreigners, right, precisely because they are U.S. Blacks, they are then treated with a specialized status where they have an access to a lifestyle that even Russian citizens during this time did not have an access to.
Right.
And so it shifts their perspective in terms of understanding themselves possibly as Americans, but also many of them just talk about understanding themselves as human on a certain level, right, mm-hmm. that stepping outside the context of race relations in the U.S. Allows one to see other kinds of ethnic distinctions, national distinctions, and maybe it changes your perspective on yourself. I think many of the travel writers talk about not really feeling like American citizens in the U.S., but then abroad, have a perspective of themselves as American, or understand themselves as American, for better or for worse, right, in that context. And so I think there's a kind of freedom that Dorothy Westerly experiences there, even for someone who had a relatively sheltered life. Mm-hmm. She experiences this sense of freedom that allows her to explore, experiment, both in terms of her own sexuality and in terms of her writing. And I'm not suggesting so much the writing that she gets done there, but especially the writing that she does afterwards. Mm-hmm. I feel like she comes back from that experience, if not a communist, certainly with a different perspective on class relations that she then puts into her fiction. And for the, I think for, you know, Nancy Prince, her definition as a traveler in many ways allows her to escape the noose of slavery, at one point even using her Russian affiliation to prevent people from bringing her off the ship when a ship is docked and a slave state. And she's able to use that protection,
right,
of herself as not, you know, not an American, not a subject, not subjected to the noose or the lash in that way. Mm-hmm. So I do think that travel in that sense, and just in terms of, I think, even just thinking of Black women as travelers, when the predominant notion of even the fugitive slave would be that of a male, right, a male escaping sort of on his own, mm-hmm. as opposed to women who, in fact, are all, you know, free and moving you know, with a contested mobility, right? It's not as if they can go anywhere they want.
Right.
And certainly not, obviously, white women also face these challenges as well. And works like Jennifer Stedman's work and Cheryl Fish, they really look at Black and white women's travel narratives, especially from women who are not elite women, right? Mm-hmm. Women not on these kinds of grand tours that are sponsored by their families and chaperones, right? Women who travel in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that was very useful to think about people like Dorothy West or even Nancy Prince as, mm-hmm. as travelers who didn't have quite the same benefits as these well-off socialites, and so had, in many ways, I would suggest, a richer experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about Lee? I mean, if we think about all that you're saying, how do we factor in then with Andrea Lee, the fact that she kind of, I mean, in not just, you know, Russia Journal, but it seems to be a main tenet in all of her writing, a kind of really holding back when it comes to identity, or I don't know how if holding back is the right term, or if it's just it's very tense, this idea of her being a Black woman. So how would you say that she, or the development of her identity, development of her identity as a Black woman, comes out in her text?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, it's an ongoing theme in her work. I mean, in some ways, I think people have considered Lee, and many, you know, there's a lot of work on Sarah Phillips, you know, which is the work that is about identity and all of, and very much focused on race, as opposed to her other work, in which identity is much more muted in that way. And the emphasis there, I would say, is really on gender. Mm-hmm. One difference is that, you know, Andrea Lee she is to some extent an expatriate, right? She leaves, she doesn't come back.
Right.
Unlike, you know, Dorothy West, right, who comes back and is part of this community and continues to write out of that context. Andrea Lee ultimately, you know, lives in Italy, you know, has a family there. And I think for her, you know, so she, I think her, her perspective, which is, you know, definitely an internationalist perspective, isn't one that, like the earlier Black writers like Baldwin, or even someone like Jesse Fawcett, who all did the similar kinds of travel, but all wanted to cast their lot with their brethren in the U.S.
Right,
to use
right.
their language. That is not, Andrea Lee doesn't do that. And I think, I don't know that we can look to Russian Journal necessarily for the seeds of why that happens in her work, but certainly the perspective that she takes there, which is very much a cloaked, protective one, that only at certain moments highlights her visibility or the visibility of race, right? Mm-hmm. And that is part of, I think, a growing trend in what people would call post-civil rights literature, right? Mm-hmm. How to rethink a different relationship to racial identity, one that is a hybrid,
right,
many ways, and I think is part of the discourse around mixed race, but one that is also, I think, because of the internationalist impulse in her work, that is also a kind of a throwback to the early cosmopolitan literature of people like Henry James in some ways, right? It's also, there's also that aspect to it as well, of the notion of someone as a kind of freed up citizen of the world that she tries to bring to her work. Although, her identity is, it's not as if it's also present there in moments and flashes.
Sure, sure, definitely. I mean, I guess, one can definitely walk away from Lee or any of the other two, Dorothy West as well as Prince, saying that whether one speaks of it or, speaks of it freely or is restrained in their discussion of race, their racial identity, it's still there. It's still present, right? It's still something that we're looking for, at least. And maybe, I guess maybe this is a nice movement into the question of performance as race. What role does performance, something that's obviously a main theme in Dorothy West's writing as well, is a question of performance and what role it plays in the development of one's identity as coming from a particular class, as coming from, as being Black. What role does performance play, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I think, especially around class, I think, there's a way in which one likes to think of certain kinds of class entitlements as organic in a way, right? Something has to do with someone's particular birth or upbringing, and this leads to a kind of entitlement that is just, built on and solidified over the years. And I feel like in Dorothy West fiction, she's really trying to show how those assumptions are really overturned by others' ability to perform more effectively the accoutrements of class than those who theoretically would have been born to it, right? And I mean, that's a strong theme in The Living is Easy, where, you have someone like Cleo as a anti-heroine in some way, climbing her way and becoming a kind of icon within Black Boston society, by virtue of being able to perform an idealized notion of middle class or upper middle class Black womanhood simply because of how she looks and her behavior and what she takes on, as opposed to the reality that she's, born in South Carolina, right? Mm-hmm. And, doesn't really, she's not a Bostonian, right? Whereas her daughter Judy, who does have, is a Bostonian because she's darker skinned, does not fit as easily into the construct of the kind of womanhood that, or the kind of womanhood that is being idealized as emblematic of Black achievement and advancement, right, during the moment. So I think in the issue of performance relates certainly to class and to gender and issues. It's very much tied up with issues of respectability and all of those things. I feel like West tries to show our buffers created by the Black middle class to ensure a kind of economic success and stability. Mm-hmm. But these performances are very tenuous in many ways because they are performances.
Right.
And also because capitalism is very adept at maintaining what it needs to survive.
Right.
So even as people try and find ways to manipulate situations to their benefit, like in The Living is Easy when Cleo is looking for a house that's going to solidify her class position, almost at the same moment that she does this, she also sows the seeds of its own undoing by doing the very thing that people are concerned that Black folks will do, which is taking in boarders, right? once they're in a certain community. And so I think, West pokes fun at that and satirizes this idea of putting on airs and also portrays the cost that such performances, especially if marriage decisions are made with such blatant class aspirations in mind, that they can result in real personal unhappiness, and often against the true wishes of the spirit, right? And I think that's what destroys many of the lives or constricts many of the lives of the characters she's looking at.
Yeah.
Are people who are so invested in performing a particular kind of racial or class-based identity that is out of sync with their inner desires.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that becomes very clear to me, or with anyone, I guess, that may read The Living Is Easy, is that, you know, West is acutely aware of the, you know, intricacies or and complexities and also instabilities, I guess, of interracial class positions. She demonstrates it so well. And it kind of suggested to me after reading your chapter that, you know, again, this is more than, you know, you may find autobiographical elements, but she's being quite critical of the Black bourgeoisie.
I was going to say, yeah, and that, and I think she is very critical. Mm-hmm. And yet that critique is also, within that critique, there's also a certain admiration, right? Mm-hmm. For especially the figure of Bart Judson in The Living Is Easy, who is certainly based on her father, right? Yeah. The kind of intrepid rags to riches story.
Yeah.
And against all odds to achieve this tenuous foothold, right? There is also an admiration for that. Mm-hmm. At the same time that there's a critique. And I think that's the real tension that's in her work, right? On one hand, wanting to acclaim the achievements, right, in the midst of great adversity, but also that what it takes sometimes to maintain those achievements are the things that maybe are not so admirable, right? Mm-hmm. And that's very much the tension, I think, that one experiences when reading her work, and also makes her perspective very hard to place.
Sure, sure.
Place there. I mean, I think it's there is a real, especially as a literary critic, there's a real desire to want to claim Living Is Easy as almost an anti-capitalist text. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't quite get there.
Right.
I think because there is still that, again, a little bit that holding back, a little bit of that little bit of admiration there, mm-hmm. That's still present, and a lot of empathy, I think, for the position the characters find themselves in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I, as you're talking, I'm just thinking about when you're talking about highlighting, you know, not necessarily being very critical of the Black bourgeoisie, but also in various ways seeming, admiring of the same community of people. It reminds me of some of the difficulties I have, or the responses that students have in reading this text today, in 2012. Not necessarily being able to see that satire. I was just kind of wondering, you know, how do you deal with that? Have you encountered the same thing? Is it difficult to teach a text where the author is being critical, but also you can see that kind of admiration? There's no clear-cut stance of where the individual her position on the Black bourgeoisie?
Yeah, you know, I think it can be challenging, but one thing I think students do relate to, and I had this experience in a classroom that I went to visit here at Stanford, mm-hmm. as well, is that they really do understand the persistence of colorism, mm-hmm. Not just within the African-American community, but within other communities that have been exposed to or under colonial rule, mm-hmm. at one point. Mm-hmm. So when I was talking to students about the issues, especially around color that appear in a book like The Living Is Easy, in which light skin is associated with kind of class standing, right? Mm-hmm. Even if people don't really have that class standing, they're sort of presumed to have it, mm-hmm. right? The lighter that they are. And that's something that within many communities of color, people still see, right? And can attest to that as a vestige of racialized hierarchies, right? Mm-hmm. Class and color hierarchies. And so, well, certainly, right, it's a book from, you know, the 1940s, which actually even looks back to an even earlier time.
Yeah.
I think that that's where students see some connection in terms of still seeing how certain ideals around skin color persist in their own lives and culture. And then I think it does require getting students to understand their own class position requires a little more work, because I think U.S. is very invested in class not being a barrier to an advancement, right? That's
right.
The story, right, is that you can, you know, that's the Horatio Alger myth, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very critical to the notion of a success in American culture, that class is not an impediment. And yet I think a book that shows that these barriers are, you know, they're harder to surmount than you think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Draws attention to students' understanding of their own class status. So often when I'm teaching Dorothy West work and works look at class in this way, I find myself asking students to reflect upon, are there any difference between, is there a difference between, say, how they would categorize themselves and actually what their class status is, right? So you find often in American society that most people want to identify as middle class,
right,
even not, right?
Right.
It seems to be the appropriate stance to have for people who are sometimes really more upper middle class in terms of what their family income is, or working class, right,
mm-hmm.
in the same way. And so I think getting students to understand the nuances,
mm-hmm.
and also the reality that not a lot of people actually shift class over their lifetime.
Right, right.
Despite the fact that that's an enduring myth of success in our culture. And I feel like in looking at both the flexibility and Wes being able to poke fun at what class advancement might look like, but also the fact that there's also kind of elastic bounce back as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then despite all the father's success, and despite all of the mother and Cleo's machinations within the living is easy, at the end they're destitute.
Right, right.
And so then you wonder, well, has this experiment been a success? What does it tell us about the possibility of being able to pass on wealth? Is that something that's specific to communities of color? Or is it something that, say, mainstream also class also struggles with as well?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'd say both. Yeah. All right. So just kind of as we're talking more and more about color, I want to go to your chapter on two weddings.
Oh.
Yeah. And can you just outline for us what your main objectives within this chapter were?
Okay, so it's one of the latter chapters in the book, Two Weddings, and it looks at Dorothy West's novel, The Wedding,
mm-hmm.
as well as Oprah Winfrey's cinematic interpretation of The Wedding as in one of her very early, I think it's almost her first endeavor in this area, interpretation of the book starring Halle Berry. And in many ways, part of why The Wedding was important, Oprah Winfrey's version of it, is that for people who don't know a lot about Dorothy West, it kind of triggers their memory. Oh yeah, we did see that movie with Halle Berry on Martha's Vineyard.
Right, right.
And it also the production of it, as well as the publication of this book that was billed as the last novel from this writer from the Harlem Renaissance, really did bring the spotlight back on Dorothy West, and in a way that allowed a kind of recovery for her in popular society. And so in that sense, I was glad of that, of the spotlight being shown back on her, I think, just prior to her death. But so that's kind of the background. What I wanted to do in terms of putting into context the TV movie version of The Wedding and the novel was to actually show how in many ways our society still can't grasp the concept of people who look white but are black,
mm-hmm.
essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that in trying to translate this from a book to the screen, they couldn't actually translate that aspect of the book,
right.
Of this family on the Oval, where, you know, the heroine is essentially a blonde, blue-eyed, you know, throwback to her forebears.
Yes.
They can't and can only and have to try and use other ways to signify racial mixing, because the concern would be then that people somehow wouldn't relate or wouldn't understand that as a phenomenon. And it just speaks to, I think, our rigid understanding of racial identity,
mm-hmm.
And our investment in visibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be able to see them to identify them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in The Wedding, I think what's interesting about The Wedding is the idea of looking at those who, in fact, you don't see.
Right.
Right? And yet for various reasons are still, even in very complicated ways, understanding themselves as African Americans, mm-hmm. Despite the fact that they don't visibly identify, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an aspect that is ultimately not really translatable.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to look at. So the two weddings become, you know, are definitely connected, but they seem to be advancing very different ideas.
Right. Well, sorry. Mm-hmm. I cut you off. What did you say? The last part?
Oh, no, that was it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it seems to me that just going along with what you just said, where you ended up, it seems that Oprah Winfrey's intention was to show another Black community, you know, different from the ones often highlighted in the mainstream, to a broader audience. I don't think that she was necessarily speaking to Black audiences out there, but that this other Black community exists seems to be a given to West. And she's now moved on to looking at some of the, you know, intricacies and complexities of being within various Black communities. So the goals that both texts have are different, right? Would you agree, disagree?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think what is presented in the film is almost a kind of dreamlike setting that very much capitalizes on achievement, you know, that Black people have kind of achieved this paradise, right, to kind of draw on a theme in my title, on this island here, and the wedding becomes this, can be the celebration of it. And even though there are elements that work to upend the wedding and the resolution, it still is resolved, right, in a fairly conventional way, right, mm-hmm. and since the wedding happens. Whereas in the book, it's not resolved at all, right? And the real violence that undergirds the family's legacy is much, much more present mm-hmm. in the book than it is in the film, mm-hmm. right? That these are, that their connections to, that essentially much of the family's wealth is founded on sexual exploitation, right?
Yeah.
In many ways. And one that gets, that continues, right? Or decisions that are marriage decisions that are quite mercenary,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so that's a very different trajectory.
Sure.
You know, the book itself also is very much done in flashbacks. And in many ways, the heroine, Shelby, the Halle Berry character in the film, is almost like an empty center within the book, right? She's present, but she's not really the main story. It's almost like that's the narrative thread that you're following. Will she or will she not get married? But the story is really the story of her ancestors in the novel. Whereas in the film, I think, you know, it is much more focused on Halle and this decision that she has to make. And it's framed, I think, in a much more late 20th, early 20th century kind of framework. You know, will I marry the white man or the Black man?
Right.
And it's kind of about, you know, maybe a kind of racial authenticity, you know, mm-hmm. which will she choose? And in many ways, that is often how the Black middle class is lampooned and continued to be lampooned, mm-hmm. I think, within even within the more popular films like Tyler Perry, you know, films. And of course, there's even a new Martha's Vineyard wedding movie called Jumping the Broom that performs the same kind of things mm-hmm. in terms of lampooning the Black middle class as assimilationist sellouts in many ways, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Dorothy Westbrook was trying to do more than that, right? It was trying to both look at, yes, there is this cost of separation, right? And these borders that do have to be policed mm-hmm. in many ways. But there's also, there is still a sense of, again, of linked faith, and the complications of uplift are still present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, do you think, I'm just thinking, just like you said, you're drawing on another, you know, movie that's come out recently. And I'm wondering, jump the broom I'm talking about, do you think it's easier to demonstrate the ambiguities of racial phenotype on the stage as opposed to on a movie screen?
You know, I think that's possible, and possibly just because within theater, mm-hmm. You see more colorblind casting,
mm-hmm.
Right? There's less of in theater. I don't know, you know, it's because of artifice or because it's just a genre where, you know, there is not always the need.
Mm-hmm.
There's still sometimes the need, right? But not mm-hmm. always the need mm-hmm. to have the characters racially or racially visually represent what they are, right? So you can have, I'm trying to think of some recent, I feel like there was a projection of Lady Macbeth with Angela Bassett or something like that.
Oh, is that right?
And, you know, there are a few instances where you see that. I'm not, colorblind casting isn't necessarily prevalent all the way along, but it is more prevalent in theater than it is in film, where there's still that sense or that dependence on realism in a way. And I think it's that investment in realism that sometimes means that you need to have characters that if audiences see these visual disjunctions, they won't believe them in some way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was one of the problems with The Wedding. I do think, though, that that is probably changing. I almost wonder if The Wedding was made today, if it might be cast very, I mean, obviously there would be different people, but I think the ideology behind the casting of that film might be very different.
Sure.
Because you have many actors and actresses now who really do exist as ambiguously plays initially and sometimes fill different kinds of roles. People like Zoe Saldana, or particularly a lot of Latino actresses, and Mary Beltran's done a lot of work on that, the notion of the mixed race actor as this, as an actor that can appeal as a figure of mediation, right? Which is in some ways old, right? We know that these figures within fiction, right? We know that we've always had these characters that in passing novels,
right?
Particularly a lot of early African-American fiction, we've had these characters that are trying to both embody black and white, engage empathy and sympathy on both sides. So in some ways, that's not necessarily a new concept, but it is definitely with language around issues like if we were really post-race, for instance, can we then do colorblind ensemble casting?
Right.
So we do see some of that beginning to go on, I think, in contemporary culture.
In terms of the color, though, in terms of it, hello?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I thought the call dropped. All right. But in terms of color, this summer, Sanaa Lathan was in a play on the stage called By the Way, Meet Vera Stark.
Oh.
Have you heard of it?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, she plays a maid to a starlet. Who, you know, long story short, in the end, the starlet is her first cousin. But everybody else, she's passing. Everybody else thinks that she's a white woman. She certainly identifies as a black woman, but is actually in private with between her and Sanaa. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of confusion about the different views of black people in the play. So that's why I was, you know, that's what kind of fueled the question I had about whether it's easier to kind of get to some of the things that Dorothy West is trying to, the intricacies or the complexities of race phenotypically. You know, that's where I was trying to go with that question. The other thing, though, just in terms of your response here, it got me thinking in terms of it would be possible, or maybe the casting would be different today. I wonder, because, you know, recently had this book, The Help, and we have the book, and when we also have the movie version. And in the book, there's a scene where one of the maid's daughters is sent away, and it's clear that she's sent away because she's biracial, or so fair that people can't believe that she's this maid's daughter. Yet still in the movie, there's absolutely no indication of that. The daughter does return in the movie, but she's a dark-skinned woman. So they completely erase the difference in color between Constantine and her daughter. And so I'm wondering, you know, is it just that there's a legacy of sexual exploitation here in the U.S.? It's very difficult still to even talk about.
I do. I think there's that legacy of sexual exploitation. I also think there's a legacy of black female desirability, right? Even in that way, that is somehow seen as unbelievable, right? Because if you have, if in the film, I remembered that from the book, I noticed, I was betting that the film was not going to pick up on that, right? One, because it's a, in a film you condense things and it's a more complicated storyline, right? Yeah. But I feel like it's one that that we could have inferred, right?
Sure, sure.
The reason why the daughter is so much of a problem isn't just because she's uppity,
yes,
right?
Right.
Because on her body is this evidence of mixed race, right?
Yes.
That somebody has possibly even the man of the house.
Right, right, right.
And that is a way in which servants were regularly subjected to, going back to Strom Thurmond's daughter, right?
Yes.
And it's a history that, as the Black community, that we're very familiar with, because we understand why there's a range of skin tones, right?
Right, right.
And I think that the assumption that somehow that would not be easily understandable within a mainstream, society, as if that they would somehow, that would be a mystery, right? How
right.
did she like, right?
Right.
And even within the book, they describe her, they don't really suggest that it's from, the book actually dismisses the possible sexual
exploitation. That's right. Yeah,
and
that's true.
The book says, oh, she's kind of like a throwback child, right?
Right.
An earlier generation, right? Not the father of the heroine, right?
Right, right?
He's maintained in terms of his integrity, right? Mm-hmm. And I think in the film, possibly they could not have been able to maintain the integrity of the family mm-hmm. without that.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't surprised to see that they substituted that in there, because there would have felt to have been this explanation. Whereas I think understanding in West Texas is that the explanation has been clear for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
That what put these women in jeopardy was not just, evil mistresses, but it was in fact the consistent exploitation of the husbands as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a story that we know and that Black women have told.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean,
right, but yet it's not part of the story that the film, or really the book, wanted to get at.
Right, right, right. She kind of shirked that part of, it was clear that it was just kind of a dismissal. There was opportunity for her to talk about something there, but she talked about Catherine Stockett. She really didn't. So anyways, I guess the point that I was trying to make, or just kind of think about there, asking you to kind of comment on, is the fact that these discussions of racial phenotype are not new. They're not new. They're not old. They're here. They're still with us right now. They're still present. And that Dorothy West was really trying to investigate those questions in ways that it seems that people aren't really getting at today. And I don't know if it's because of that translation into the movie screen that exists. All right. So in your coda, you say that you wanted to, quote, offer a glimpse into the multiple geographies that Dorothy West inhabited and how those spaces shaped and were shaped by her writing. I think you did an amazing job. You also say that you sought to understand the evolution of intra-racial class and color divisions over the course of the 20th century. Did you find an evolution?
What my sense is that, and it's something that I have a lot of ambivalence about, is that within the Black community, those class divisions are widening in a way that they've continued to widen, right? So not just in terms of the idea that one group has had more success over time, which, they have, but also that another group in many ways has remained stagnant and in some ways even more circumscribed than before. And many people point to, after the Civil Rights Movement, that, what integration did in terms of a term that I've heard just recently called bright flight.
Bright flight,
right. Or you get like the idea that after within Black communities, and once integration happened, that the class of say people who were doctors or lawyers or teachers could now go live somewhere else, right? They didn't have to stay within the Black community, and so resulted in those communities losing the kind of, this is a kind of theory of ghettoization, right? That
right.
lost certain kinds of role models, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so. But then, what then was left in terms of advancement or achievement.
Right. Like a brain drain.
In that sense.
Yeah.
It's complicated now because you also have the situation of those same, say, professionals that may have fled, you know, in the 80s, returning, right?
Yes.
returning to those communities as well. So I think that complicates things. So I do feel, however, though, that, you know, that there is, even though there are widening class divisions, that there is still, a sense of linked fate that in many ways, I think many of the discussions around post-race mm-hmm. have been, I feel like that's, for some of the discussions, especially the discussions that have emerged with regards to people who want post-race to be a kind of freeing for like Blacks to somehow be individuals, right? And mm-hmm. that line of thinking, that there is this sense that that's what the division is allowed, right? That rather than the kinds of critiques of the Black middle class to sell out for Uncle Tom's, there is maybe even a kind of shaking off of that kind of identification mm-hmm. at all, right? And I think this is part of what's behind the desire to say, for instance, identify, the changing identification of even the term mixed race, you know, yes. has to mean something very different in the 21st century than it does in the 19th century, right? Mm-hmm. Where people, I think now maybe trying to show not so much mixed race, but they say that they're bicultural,
right?
Two different cultures that have kind of blended, as opposed to say somebody in Harriet Jacobs, she was not bicultural.
That's right.
Even though she was technically mixed race, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like, you know, these issues of color and class, they're still present. And so, but there has been, I would say, you know, that they change over time. Sure. They change in response to the economic moment. One of the groups during this past recession, which maybe is we are beginning to emerge out from, was very devastating to the Black middle class, mm-hmm. who so much of their income was invested in property. Right. I think something that Wes writes about all the time. And so there was this way in which, again, an example of almost like in The Living is Easy, in which advancement is tenuous and can be undermined.
Yes.
In a fell stroke. So I guess now I'm wondering, well, has there been so much
an evolution? Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think there has been an evolution, but it's not one that's a kind of linear movement. Right. Just as history is not linear, right, in terms of how we move through it. So I think, you know, there are changes, and I feel like that's why West writing does offer insight into thinking about class dynamics intrinsically, even though, right, she's a writer from, say, who wrote, 50 years, 60 years ago.
Yeah, still so relevant, still so pertinent, the themes that she's dealing with, even today. Well, Sheree, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we go, can you just tell us what you're working on now? What can we expect up from you soon?
Well, I think I'm a little bit of a breather.
Yeah.
I'm continuing to work, you know, my work in the Harlem Renaissance. I'm hoping to put together an anthology for teaching anthology of the companion to the Harlem Renaissance.
Right.
I'm working on that now. I'm also really interested in terms of my ongoing interest in recovery. I've been thinking, it was very much inspired by Lois Brown's biography of Pauline Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about both Pauline Hopkins and also the sculptor Ammonia Lewis, mm-hmm. You know, because I've had this continual interest in visual culture and literary culture. And I'm not sure what form the latest project will take. It might actually be more of a creative form. I feel like the transition from writing my first book to a biography, which is somewhat of a different medium.
Yes.
The literary critic has opened up for me maybe different modes of writing and engagement. And so that might be the direction that my next recovery project takes.
Right. Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you.
And we wish you all the very best.
Thanks, Sheree.
You're listening to the interview series, New Books in African American Studies. Today, I've been talking with Professor Shireen Sherard Johnson as she discusses her new book, Dorothy West's Paradise, a biography of class and color. I'm your host, Sheree Johnson, and I look forward to seeing you next time.